Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The most common chronic disease among children and teenagers is tooth decay. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The good news is that it's easily preventable. A thin coating painted onto the surface of teeth called sealants are one of the most effective ways to prevent cavities. The National Children's Dental Health Project released a report today that said providing recommendations to bolster sealant programs in schools. Joining us is the Dental Sealant Program Manager at Columbus Public Health, Eva Harrison. Eva is a registered dental hygienist with 25 years of experience in the field, and we welcome her. Hi.
Hi, Anne. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is licensed school nurse for Columbus City Schools, Ginny Black. Ginny is not speaking on behalf of Columbus City Schools, but she was one of the sealant work group members on the new report. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Last year, the CDC urged more states to implement school-based sealant programs. First of all, what's the benefit of this, Eva?
It's absolutely amazing, the benefits of preventing decay on these children. Most of the children we see rarely get to go to the dentist. So we're seeing kids for the very first time.
Is this in kindergarten?
We typically see second and sixth graders, and we do second and sixth graders for a reason. They're getting their 6 and their 12-year molars. And then when we follow up at that school again the following year, we see the new second and sixth graders, and we'll check the third and seventh graders that we had seen the previous year to be sure that the sealants are still intact.
What actually do sealants, how do they work?
It's just a thin plastic coating. You have pits and fissures on the back chewing molar teeth, and it's a thin plastic coating that we paint over the grooves so nothing can get down into those tiny grooves to cause where the bulk of the decay started to cause the cavities.
I had that done a few years ago, and it makes your teeth feel fuzzy for a few days.
In the beginning, it will feel a little bumpy. We tend to tell the kids once they eat, it'll wear down, and they won't even know they're in there.
Okay.
But sealants are the only proven thing that are out there that will help prevent decay. They're proven to last up to 10 years as well.
What kind, when you see the kids, Ginny Black, in the schools, when you first see them, when you're first checking them out, what are you seeing? I mean, what do their mouths look like?
Well, the kids that have seen a dentist look pretty well. But we have children that have not seen the dentist. We actually screen in pre-K, K, 1, 3, and 5. And we check the teeth of the kids, and we hook them up with dentists if they need to be seen.
But do they have that many more cavities? Is it that noticeable?
Yes.
You can tell the difference right away.
Yes.
Just by looking at their mouths.
And not only that, we have research that shows that those kids are not at school as often and they have lower grades.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine if you have a toothache, that could be a problem. But is it that simple or is this more of a socioeconomic correlation, Eva?
There's definitely a socioeconomic correlation. It's amazing the difference in getting these children, the children who've been to the dentist before versus I go in and do presentations for the program 2 weeks prior. When I go in and do presentation, there'll be a line of children coming up going, look at my hole in my tooth. Are you saying that's not supposed to be there? So lots of times they don't even know that that's not normal. It's not normal to have a toothache or a cavity, and it breaks my heart to see this.
And by the way, dentistry, dental hygiene, that none of that's covered by Medicaid, even if you are in the income group that qualifies for that, that's not covered, right? Is it for children, isn't it?
Dental sealants are covered. They cover them once a year, or once in a lifetime, though, is all. So they'll get them one time. So we want to make sure they're on there and it's a good, healthy tooth. That's the reason, like I said, we do second, sixth grade. We want to get the tooth when it's fresh, and the likelihood of there being any decay on it is better.
Ginny, you were a member of the report team. What were some of the recommendations you came up with for what makes a successful sealant program in schools? What works?
We looked at first making sure that the people that are putting the sealants on understand the cultures they're working with, that they understand the tooth eruption pattern so that they do see the kids at the best grades, that we use a universal system to grade the teeth so that we're communicating with each other in an effective way. We also looked at how to work with Medicaid so that these programs are well-funded.
We're talking about dental prevention efforts in Columbus City Schools. And my guests, you just heard from Ginny Black. She's a licensed school nurse for Columbus City Schools. And today she's talking about her efforts inside the school. She's not speaking for the school district. Also, Ava Harrison, she's a dental sealant program manager for Columbus Public Health. If you have a question or comment about this program, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ava, many schools are already strapped for resources, especially in Columbus City Schools. I mean, they've got a lot of issues associated with that same socioeconomic correlation that we just talked about. How do they fund this program? Who pays for it?
We are funded three different ways. We have grant funding through ODH. We have the health department itself. And then we have our Medicaid funding. So those three different sources are what keep us afloat.
Is it different, Ginny, in different schools? Is it evenly distributed? How does that work? Obviously, it's the grade schools, but then there's also the high school level.
Well, we target the younger kids. As they get older and they get adult teeth, if they don't see a dentist, then they're at risk to get those cavities in those teeth. But generally, we're looking now at pre-K and kindergarten, getting those kids into care, getting those cavities filled, getting sealants on their teeth so they're not getting more cavities. We obviously see more in lower poverty areas. Suburban schools have less issues, but then parents there are cash strapped to provide insurance, and we're seeing more people without dental insurance.
Are you seeing this becoming more widespread,
we
Ava?
Are, but I think a lot of the problem that is out there, and I brought a soda today. Do you know there are 17 packs of sugar in one 20-ounce bottle of your sugary beverage? Would you ever dump 17 packs of sugar in your mouth?
I was wondering, what's that rattling and you're getting sugar back?
And these kids are consuming this on a regular basis. A second grader should have no more than 3 teaspoons of sugar.
A day?
A day. And they're having 17 in one soda. Chocolate milk, a 14-ounce chocolate milk, has 11 teaspoons of sugar in it. Why are we not serving basic white milk and then a small bottle of water?
Well,
water by choice is the absolute best.
It was a thing a few years ago that they eliminated pop. And they eliminated sugary drinks in pop machines or whatever
yes.
you want to call them in schools, right?
They did. That they have stopped. But
and
when you're
waters,
talking
finally bottled waters, finally
the
taken
number
over,
one.
Number one. But still, it's a problem.
Right. And the reason I was told they offer chocolate milk is because kids don't like white milk. So let's give them the
then
best
give them
thing.
Water?
Let's give them water then instead of the chocolate milk.
Well, Ginny,
I'm a proponent of water first for thirst and a proponent of white milk at meals because we are giving kids the necessary nutrients in that.
There's vitamins that are put in there, yeah.
Yes. But I think people don't have a good idea of what that sugar is in. Sports drinks
right.
have as much sugar as this.
Right.
And they're promoted. You really do not need a sports drink unless you have done an hour of heavy exercise. You should be drinking water instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing is those little mini sports drinks after the little soccer game where they've exerted practically no energy. Should every child receive sealants? Is this across the board, Ava?
If I had my way, every child would receive dental sealants. They're the only proven thing that are out there to help.
And do you notice a real difference from one year to the next? So you do the follow-up exams. How are you seeing a result from this?
If they're still intact, they're looking great. It makes a big difference. It's amazing to me to go into these schools and see a second grader who's got their new six-year molar and it is bombed out. The tooth is rotted off. How can a second grader, they just got that tooth, how can it be broken off and rotted to that degree?
They're and that eating must and hurt, right?
Oh, they're eating and drinking too much sugar and they're not brushing their teeth.
And it's and that is a dental emergency. If you have a dental abscess, the infection from that tooth can go throughout your body.
Septic.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so dental health is equal to physical health. If that tooth hurts, you can't concentrate. You don't retain information. Plus, we know when people hurt, they're not happy. Mentally, they're not at their best.
So what's new about the program, Ava?
Well, the program's been around for 30 years.
Yeah.
I'm new with the program. I've been with the program for 3 years, but I'm the new program manager. My goal is to try to get it out there more so. We have a new video that we created with the ODH this past year that's being used throughout the state of Ohio. It's called Seal in a Smile. You can Google it. It's a great new video that shows the kids step by step of what we're doing. We want them to understand nothing hurts. There are no needles. There are no shots. And when I go in and do presentations, we simply present it that it's not nail polish, but it is as easy as painting your nails. We use a magic light to dry it. Voila, it's done. It's mm-hmm. that simple.
Yeah. How long does it take? How does it work, Ginny?
They come into our schools. They can set up anywhere. The child comes in. They apply the sealant. They're back in class within a half hour.
Do you have to get parental permission?
Yes, I do.
Is that difficult?
In some cases.
Getting them to respond?
Yes.
To
we
the
send the
slip.
Permission yeah. slips home. Eva comes in and talks to our kids so that they can take the permission slip home. But, parents come in all types. If they don't understand what the benefit is, that I send a note home with the link to that video because parents need to see what's happening and uh-huh. why this will help. This is the best bet with your public health dollar for these kids. And I think that these kids will pass it on to their generation. I think that we need to do more on a wide scale to let parents know why it's important. I don't think there's the ability to call every parent, but at open houses, if we can reach parents there, at school functions, if we can reach parents there.
But, often, parents are busy and they're not able to go to that kind of thing. Just one last question, Ava Harrison, what dynamic is in place or what strategy is in place to reach the immigrant English as a second language population in Columbus? I know that's that's culturally it's probably a change for some people. There's a language barrier, a cultural barrier. What do you do?
We do everything we can possible. We have separate forms for them.
Okay.
English and Spanish speaking forms.
But what about Bhutanese and
a lot of those languages?
Somali. Yeah.
A lot of those parents. It's a new language as far as writing them.
Yeah.
And so we don't use those. And lots of times we have to rely on the school's interpreters to get to the parents mm-hmm. to say, hey, the dental sealant program is coming. This is something wonderful for your child. And they walk through with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I work with the English as a second language teachers to let the parents know. The kids are really receptive to this. They go home. They tell their parents. This is one of the groups that I am able to meet the needs of. Mm-hmm. And the kids are very receptive. And since they're new to this country, we can put the sealants on and then we can work with them to get into a dental home to get the care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how about as far as the follow up goes? Pete and Pataskala, you're on the air. Hi, Pete.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead.
My question was, it sounds like from what I heard earlier, that you're basically putting a plastic sealant on the teeth. And I was just curious if you've done any research on or have any information about any potential health effects with that. You know, it seems nowadays where there's a big push for removing plastics from, you know, plates, silverware, cups, BPA, all that kind of stuff. I was just wondering how this affected any of that.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Pete. Any fears about that?
There's been an immense amount of research around this, and the research has not found any adverse effects.
Okay. All right. Well, we have to cut it off there, but thank you so much for joining us, Eva Harrison, Dental Sealant Program Manager for Columbus Public Health.
Appreciate your
time.
Thanks.
And Jeannie Black, a licensed school nurse for Columbus City Schools, speaking not on behalf of Columbus City Schools today, but as a community nurse that cares about the oral health of our children. Thanks for joining us.
I appreciate you having me.
More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The relationship between body mass index and mortality has gone back and forth in the public health community for years. Earlier research has suggested that carrying a few extra pounds may extend a person's life. A recent study, a new study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine last week suggests that being slightly overweight may actually cut a lifespan short. So who's right? Dr. David Katz, founding director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center and past president of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, recently wrote about that. He joins us by phone from Connecticut. Welcome back.
Nice to be with you, Ann. Thank you.
It's called the obesity paradox. So first of all, before we get into what the paradox is, what do we mean by obesity? Because I just said a few pounds here, a few pounds there. Are we talking about a few pounds or what?
Well, you know, it's interesting because a majority of adults in the United States are overweight or obese. So, you know, it's nothing very extreme. We see it all around us every day. But there's a strict definition. Obesity is a body mass index of 30 or above, and overweight is a body mass index of 25 or above. And this is the weight in kilograms over the height in meters squared. So it's essentially height-adjusted weight. But, you know, the eyeball test works pretty well, and these measures essentially correspond well to what we think we see when we look around. We can see people who are completely lean and who have flat bellies. We see people who've got a little bit of extra weight. Generally, that would be the overweight category. And then people where the excess weight looks like, you know, it's a bit more, and that's where obesity starts, and then that's measured in stages. And there have actually been studies over the years sort of comparing what people think they're seeing with formal measures of excess body fat, and they line up pretty well. So it depends. We could be talking about just a very little bit of overweight, and that's overweight. We could be talking about more, and that's obesity.
So what's the paradox, the obesity paradox? What do we mean by that?
So that's the crux of the matter and what this new study is about and why the topic's so interesting now. So the obesity paradox, and you queued it up very nicely, suggests that it's actually better for health, so avoiding chronic disease, avoiding premature death, to be a little overweight. Now, you know, it almost seems oxymoronic. Shouldn't the definition of a normal weight be the weight associated with the best health outcomes? Otherwise,
right. Why
is it normal, right? Well, the problem with all of the prior research on the topic that has propagated this notion of an obesity paradox, a benefit from being a bit heavier, is that it has looked at weight at just one time. And here's the thing, speaking as a physician who's cared for patients for the past 25 years, sick people tend to lose weight. So if we look at a population of older people, and that's the population that tends to be prone to chronic disease and death, and we ask what weight in this older group is associated with the worst outcomes, well, it turns out being a little bit overweight in older age looks to be better than being lean, And the reason is many of the people lean in older age were overweight a decade before and have been losing weight because they're ill. And so now we have a new study, the one you just referenced, mm-hmm. newly out in the Annals of Internal Medicine, and it looked at outcomes in over 225,000 people. And so a very, very large database, followed these people for over a decade, and did something the previous studies had not done. It looked at weight change over time. So it didn't just ask, what do people weigh now? But what was the peak weight they had in the past, and what do they weigh now? And here's what we learned. Being lean and staying lean, so you know, essentially always having a normal weight, was associated with the best health outcomes. Lean really was best. What made overweight look better? Well, it was better to be overweight in your 60s, 70s, or even 80s than to have been overweight in your 50s. And to now be thinner in your 60s or 70s, because very often that was a sign of an occult cancer or the early stages of chronic disease exacting a toll. So this basically debunks the obesity paradox notion and says lean really is best, but what we want is to achieve and maintain a healthy lean body weight. And yes, it's bad to be overweight or obese relative to being lean, but it's even worse if you're generally overweight and you start losing weight and can't account for that. That's a reason to go to the doctor and find out what's going on.
In your article, you make a point about science versus sense when we refer to that obesity paradox. What does sense tell us about human weight? And I guess you kind of made that point, but you know, obviously being fit and lean, as you put it, is the, you know, what you're shooting for, right?
Yeah, well, no question.
That
so
makes sense.
And as you likely know, I often invoke this argument about sense, whether it's about weight or about diet. You know, we carry on all the time as if we're completely clueless about the basic care and feeding of Homo sapiens, and yet we know what to feed every other species when we put members in a zoo. How can that be? So there's a certain amount of information we get just from paying attention to what goes on in the world. We know what most animals ought to eat simply because we know what they eat in their native habitat. You could extend the same reasoning to us and say, well, we don't need to be quite so clueless. We have a basic notion that a diet of wholesome foods direct from nature would be better for us and a predominance of plants and so forth. With regard to weight, much the same. Populations of human beings throughout history and around the world who are physically active on a routine basis and have access to an ample diet, but not the highly adulterated glow-in-the-dark diet of the United States today, mm-hmm. they tend to achieve and maintain a weight in the normal BMI range. In other words, it's not just normal because science tells us it's best. It's also normal because it's what healthy, vital, active, free-living human beings tend to land on. And what I wrote about in my recent column was, you know, we observe that in animals all the time. If you watch squirrels in your backyard, they all tend to be about squirrel weight. And you know, if one were just using sense rather than science, you would kind of guess that evolution and biology and natural selection had settled on the right weight for being a squirrel. So, you know, where you land under a set of circumstances that are normal for your species tells you a lot about what biology favors. And I think the same is true for us. It turns out that, you know, the standard prevailing weight among those populations of human beings and what the science tells us about best health outcomes line up perfectly.
In your article about this topic, you refer to a Bolivian Amazon population. I don't know how to pronounce it.
Simani.
Simani.
So they're interested. They've been in the news quite a bit lately, and I suspect they've made it to NPR as well as all the other programming. So this is a group of foragers or hunter-gatherers, if you will, living in the Bolivian Amazon. And what made them instantly famous is they were studied very extensively for their cardiovascular health and essentially found to have the cleanest coronary arteries of any population ever studied. Pristine, you know, no heart disease mm-hmm. whatsoever. And so, you know, all sorts of interest in their diet and their lifestyle. And in fact, their diet is 72% carbohydrate, overwhelmingly plant foods, but they do some hunting and some fishing as well. But importantly, They eat a diet of real foods direct from nature. They're physically active. For purposes of today's discussion, what's relevant is they are an example of a modern-day hunter-gatherer society. So, you know, they kind of represent that human beings in their native habitat, and they're all very lean. They have exactly what you would predict the normal weight of human beings under normal circumstances to be.
Mm-hmm.
The reason this is important, Ann, you know, this whole conversation, I think, is sort of a prelude to another conversation. We need to acknowledge that it's not easy to be lean in modern context. It's mm-hmm. not easy to be lean in America. We run on Dunkin', we peddle multicolored marshmallows as part of a complete breakfast. And people like Michael Moss, a Pulitzer Prize winner, write articles like his New York Times Magazine cover story, The Extraordinary Science of Addictive Junk Food, mm-hmm. telling us about the machinations of big food to willfully adulterate the food supply so it's impossible to stop eating. We need to acknowledge that it's extremely difficult to be lean. And if we know, beyond a doubt, on the basis of both robust science and sense, that lean is best for health, lean is associated with the least chronic disease, lean is associated with the least risk of premature death, and frankly, we do, well, then it tells us we know where there is, and we really ought to come together and work to protect our own bodies through the advent of the body politic. We need to make it easier to get there from here. And you know, frankly, we've been letting that opportunity languish for far too long already. But that's the next big thing. What do we need to change in our culture so that more people can be lean? 70% of adults in the United States are overweight or obese, and that's associated with increased risk for chronic disease and premature death. We ought to be doing something about that.
You know, we just talked earlier about the most common chronic disease among children and teens is tooth decay. And the one of the public health people I had in here talking about it said one of the big problems with it is sugared pops, sugared drinks.
Yeah, well, that's a huge problem, but it's an even bigger problem.
I guess what I was getting at is that we have the free choice. I mean, there's a real culture of freedom of choice in this country, too.
No question, and I certainly don't oppose that, and I don't want anybody telling me what I can have for breakfast, so, you know, I'm totally there with you. But I wonder, is it really free choice? You know, when children are being marketed to by highly paid executives on Madison Avenue whose bonuses depend on talking six-year-olds into what they want when mom and dad take them to the grocery store, and bombarding people every day with advertisements, not just on TV like it used to be, but interactive through the internet on their smartphones. They follow you everywhere. It's the constant murmuring of your culture telling you this is all fine. By all means, have Pop-Tarts for breakfast and Hot Pockets and drink more soda because, you know, as long as you get up and move every now and then, you'll burn off those calories and all will be well. The messages cannot be overtly false, but they can be significantly misleading. They talk you into a false reality, the notion that this isn't really a problem. The beverage industry makes the case that you can't blame obesity exclusively on soda. Well, no one's saying it's exclusively about soda, but on the other hand, soda is a major contributor. But the problem runs far beyond just soda. That's a concentrated source of excess sugar, calories, and contributes to obesity and diabetes. But again, you know, our entire modern food supply is being manipulated by scientists using functional MRI machines to study ways to stimulate the human appetite center. So, Ann, we can talk about, you know, putting power in the hands of the people, but I'm making the very case that the people are being disempowered in ways that they have absolutely no means to overcome. So first, you know, we need to establish what healthy means. And in terms of weight, it's lean.
Mm-hmm.
Second, we need to ask ourselves, can the average person with average awareness, knowledge, literacy, personal responsibility get there from here in this environment? If the answer is yes, well, okay, then we ought to try to empower everybody to be like the average. But if the answer is no, if the average person is failing, then I think we're setting the bar too high, and we need to ask ourselves, is this, you know, doing something to facilitate healthier eating, healthier drinking, is that telling people what to do, or is that simply leveling the playing field so they have a chance to protect their own health? I would argue it's the latter.
And switching gears real quickly, to another article you wrote recently about a new study published in the journal Science suggests that random DNA errors are responsible for two-thirds of cancer mutations. You write that, no, cancer isn't random or merely a product of bad luck. What are you talking about there?
Really, really important topic, because this was massively misleading. So the scientists published in the prestigious journal Science, but they'd published much the same work 2 years ago, and it got all the same media coverage then. They were studying the rate of mutations in different tissues in the body. They were not studying clinical cancers. And the only difference between the new study and the one 2 years ago is that this was an international set of cell cultures. Previously, it was just here in the United States. So it's true all around the world that the rates of random mutation vary by the tissues in our body. The more rapidly dividing cells are more prone to the kinds of mutations they were talking about. But they extend well beyond that to suggest, therefore, cancer itself is totally random, and the evidence is overwhelmingly in the other direction, because a mutation either does or doesn't turn into an actual cancer. Lifestyle has a massive influence on that. So things like diet and weight and exercise, smoking, exposure to other toxins, certain infections, together they've been estimated to have the capacity to prevent at least 60% of all cancer, and maybe more than that. And in fact, interestingly, Anne, since these two papers 2 years apart were in the prestigious journal Science, it's worth noting that right in the middle of the two came out a paper in the equally prestigious Nature looking at actual clinical cancers and the proportion of them attributable to modifiable lifestyle factors like the ones I just mentioned. And they concluded that, you know, again, 60 to 80% of cancer is preventable by lifestyle means. So mutations can occur randomly, and they vary essentially with the rate of cell replication in the body. Clinical cancers are not at all random. Now, that doesn't mean they are never random. Sometimes cancer happens despite people doing everything right. None of us gets a guarantee. But overwhelmingly, at the population level and in terms of individual risk, we have substantial control over cancer, just as we do over the other chronic diseases. Lifestyle is the best medicine. It pertains to cancer as well.
And you're concerned that when these kind of studies get revealed in this way, that people start to lose that sense of personal responsibility.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is an invitation to fatalism and apathy. Cancer is random, so it doesn't matter if I smoke. It doesn't matter what I eat. It doesn't matter whether or not I exercise. So on the one hand, it's a very bad message about cancer, and it's just fundamentally untrue, absolutely untrue. But secondly, you know, if we go back and forth, so, you know, this is a study about mutations. It's important, but it ought to be contextualized. If we seem to be going back and forth, this paper says cancer's all random, this paper in an equally prestigious journal says it's all about lifestyle, I think we cultivate distrust in scientists, because it sounds like we can't make up our minds. And ultimately, I think we cultivate disgust, and people just tune us out. And that would be a terrible mistake, because science is so powerful, but it proceeds incrementally, and we really need to put the pieces of the puzzle together to make sense out of the whole. This study was massively misrepresented.
You know, there already seems to be this trend, Dr. Katz, and I'm wondering, I just want to get your thoughts on it. You haven't necessarily written about it that I know of, but to dispute or to minimize the importance of good science.
Well, it's a huge problem today, right? And in fact, as we speak, we've got a March for Science coming up in just a couple of weeks. And
right.
You know, I mean, this is epitomized in attitudes about climate change. And what's really going on here, Anne, is that it's politically correct these days to repudiate science you find inconvenient. You know, Al Gore captured it nicely when he talked about an inconvenient truth about climate change, and we've been ignoring it ever since. What I would like to point out to people, and I'll be participating in the March for Science in New Haven, Connecticut, I'll be taking my iPhone with me and holding it up and saying, you know, if you want to refute to me the value of science, you can't tweet it to me. Because if you tweet it to me, you are pushing electrons through cyberspace in something very much like practical magic you do not understand. And you can thank a scientist for your ability to do that. If you want to refute science to me, tell me about it in a smoke signal. Because everything you make use of every day to make your modern life modern is a product of the very same scientific method that is advancing what we know about nutrition, advancing what we know about medicine, advancing what we know about the climate. And I think it's simply hypocritical to make use of the science you like to refute the science you don't. Some of the truths are convenient, some of them are inconvenient, but science is powerful. On the other hand, it's easily distorted. And when we pretend that any one study is the total answer and then change our minds the next day, we're doing a disservice to the methods of science, because science grows incrementally, and we really have to assemble the pieces bit by bit to get the big picture and a full understanding.
And then just finally, are you concerned about threats of big cuts to research at the federal level? Now, we know that that's just a proposal. We know it might not come to fruition. There's a lot of stuff that was proposed cut, but what about, I mean, it's pretty amazing the range of cuts proposed for science and research.
Yes. So you know the answer. Yes, I'm very concerned. I run a federally funded research lab. The CDC is the principal funder of the Yale Prevention Research Center. The funding for CDC is in jeopardy. The funding for the Prevention Research Center program is in jeopardy. Funding for the NIH is in jeopardy. And as you say, all of this has to make its way through Congress, and we don't expect it to come out looking as bad as it does right now.
Mm-hmm.
Just the general attitude that, you know, we don't care about science, it's an enormous mistake with regard to human potential. I mean, think about the medication available to people who are critically ill. Think about the value of medical science. But also just think about the value of science to the economy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really fascinating to be having this discussion at a time when Tesla just bypassed General Motors as the most highly valued automaker in America. The private sector is saying, we want innovation. We want new solutions that are good for the planet and the environment and kind of take us to the next level. Well, you know, that's all about scientific advance. And the United States, as a global leader in science, is highly dependent on engines of productivity like the NIH. It's a hugely rewarding investment for us as the taxpayers to be making, and to see the government threatening to take that away, I think it's clearly a threat to advances in science, and we're all very concerned about that. But frankly, it's a threat to the economy. It's our threat to our place in the world. So very much hoping that things play out differently than they look right now.
Dr. David Katz, thanks so much for joining us as usual. I always appreciate your time.
And a pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much.
Dr. David Katz is the founding director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center and past president of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Think about it. What if after you die, your body could be used to preserve the health and well-being of others? Today, when someone dies, there are a few options: funeral, cremation, or a third, body donation. According to the Associated Press, many U.S. medical schools are seeing a surge in the number of people giving their bodies to science, a trend attributed to rising funeral costs. Joining us is the Director of Anatomical Services and Body Donor Program at Ohio State University, Eileen Kalmar. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne.
Also with us is Divisional Director and Professor in the Department of Biomedical Education and Anatomy at Ohio State University, Kirk McHugh. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Not too long ago, it was taboo to donate your body, and I'm wondering if we could go back a little bit in time, because there was a day, you know, a lot of medical research began with stolen body parts and stolen cadavers because it was so taboo to donate it. Does that, do you think, Eileen, have something to do with the sort of squeamishness people might have about this whole thing?
Certainly the burden that most medical schools carry in their history of procurement carries some weight with communities not fully understanding the utilization and usefulness at this point.
What do we know about what – is there been much of an increase at Ohio State, for instance, in donations?
Yes, we have had an increase over the last 30 years. We've seen almost a doubling of donations. But we have had donations where individuals had pre-registered to donate as far back as the early and mid-60s. And last year and this year, we're seeing some of those very early donations
come to fruition.
Come to fruition, exactly.
And the baby boomer populations.
And
passing,
that level of commitment so young existed then and is perpetuating now. We do have a large number of donors in our program that are pre-registered already, about 5,000.
Does it matter that then if a lot of them are from the 60s, that means they're elderly?
Correct. Most donors are elderly.
Right. Does that change what the universe of opportunity is if you have mostly elderly?
The educational opportunities are universal.
Okay.
And I'll let Dr. McHugh speak a little bit more to that. But in general, when you consider the population that is seen often in a medical center, you have to include the elderly with that.
They're a big part of the
care population.
The care population. That's Eileen Kalmar. She's Director of Anatomical Services and Body Donor Program at Ohio State. Also with us, Kirk McHugh. He's Divisional Director and Professor in the Department of Biomedical Education and Anatomy at Ohio State University. We're talking about body donor programs. So if you have a question or comment, if you're thinking about it, and these are the people you want to talk to, they can tell you what happens when you donate your body to science. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Kirk McHugh, what's the difference between the body donor program and what they do and what you do in the Department of Biomedical Education and Anatomy at OSU?
So the body donation program is actually a part of the Department of Biomedical Education and Anatomy. So we utilize all of the cadavers that are brought in for most of the educational missions that are taught. So and this extends all the way from undergraduates who take anatomy to get into schools, graduate school, things like that, professional programs after they graduate, through graduate students who can do training and research using the cadavers, and then all the way through to our 200 medical students and about 150 dental students that use the bodies to educate themselves about the human body and its anatomy.
Typically, in any given year, how many bodies are we talking about that are donated?
Well, as Eileen said, it's been increasing, but it's been in a neighborhood of 100 to 125 bodies.
And do you use them all?
Yes, we do.
Every single one?
Yes.
And how long does a body last?
Once they are embalmed, they last for a fairly long period of time.
Like a year?
Several years.
Oh, okay.
We have donors that we are still utilizing for educational purposes that have crossed the two-decade mark.
Wow. Okay. Jay in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jay.
Hi. Hey, it's great that you're doing this. My wife and I have been having this conversation now for the past couple of months as we've been doing some estate planning and weighing the issue. And I actually had calling OSU on my to-do list. So this is great that you're doing this show.
Okay.
We've been kind of wondering about the difference between organ donation and not just, you know, the basics that you think about, but like donating skin, donating limbs and all of that stuff, as opposed to donating the entire body for medical research, and which of those two options brings the greater good?
It's an interesting question.
Is there any way that you can do both?
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Jay, thanks a lot. Kirk McHugh?
No, unfortunately, if you donate your organs in total and allow them to be used, then that sort of obviates you donating your body for research and dissection. There can be limited donations, like corneal donations alone. That body could still come into our program and then be used for various things. But they are sort of mutually exclusive to
a large
degree.
Even skin donations and that kind of thing?
Yeah, unfortunately, they are.
Why is that?
Because those components are so essential for the students understanding the anatomic structures, and their absence just makes it impossible for us to utilize the body to a great degree.
You want the whole deal.
Yes.
For study purposes.
Yes.
All right, Jay. Well, that hopefully answers your question. It certainly answered mine. But you're saying in cases of corneal donation, that's an exception. So
correct.
if someone wants to do both. And what about, is JS the – I mean, what? How do you decide what brings the greater good?
It's a great question, and I don't really think that there's a clear answer to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously donating your organs is extremely important. You can provide someone with basically life that continues on. But our educational program, we would suggest that, you know, by donating the body, you are training the next generation. And so that lives for the lifetime of the students as physicians.
Also, not everybody can donate organs because they have bloodborne diseases, that kind of a thing. So donating your body to science is an alternative in that case.
Correct.
In some cases, it can be a broader reach. Yes.
What do you mean by that?
More people might be able to participate.
Okay.
In the body donor program.
Right. Okay. All right. Jay, thanks a lot for that call. Linda in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I had a question.
Sure.
I'm in the OSU medical system, and I just love it. I'm 71, and I wanted to donate my body, and I looked into it, and there were some hefty charges involved in donating, and I wondered what the criteria was,
What charges, Eileen Kalmar?
There are no charges to donate to the OSU Body Donor Program. There are some fees associated with procuring your death certificate and transportation fees. And fortunately, OSU has just started a statewide livery service. It's only about 1 month old at this point.
Okay.
And we've taken on that financial burden for people so that there are no longer charges.
Okay. All right. Well, Linda, hopefully that answered your question. Maybe give them a call back if you're still interested. But I'm glad you asked it. I wouldn't have thought to ask that. How much is, nowadays, do you think people do this because they're just having a changing attitude about funerals and about burials and that kind of a thing? Do people talk to you about that?
We do have these conversations regularly on the phone with people that are inquiring and people that have already signed the bequeathal forms and committed to the program. There's continuing conversation about that, absolutely.
In 2011, New York Times health reporter Tara Parker Pope wrote that her mother had died of esophageal cancer and that she was very sad in the days before she died that the closest medical school turned down an offer to donate her body because she was obese. Is there a limit on that? Kirk McHugh?
Yes, there is.
Why?
Unfortunately. Because the dissections and handling of the body and embalming become extremely difficult issues when a person is grossly obese.
Is it an expense issue or a storage issue? Or
no, it's really just a functional issue. It's just too difficult to utilize the body.
But in this day and age when we have such a high percentage of obesity in our population, is there some study being done on it? I mean, are we using – is there a value there?
Definitely through the past decade, we have increased our window for donor acceptance to sort of acknowledge the fact that the population itself has gotten larger.
Uh-huh.
So obviously, if you're going to look at bodies and use them for an educational purpose, it makes sense that you do that.
But student and staff safety remains a primary concern, and students can't manipulate or move bodies that are grossly obese.
Okay.
So their safety is also principal for defining what we can accept and not.
I have a caller. I'm not going to take the call, but I'll ask a question for Nathan because we're running out of time. At what age are organs not viable for donation for study? Is there any age?
Not for study.
Okay. I don't know about – we obviously, Nathan, these folks aren't – this isn't organ donation.
No.
They don't know that.
And actually the pathogenesis that would be associated with aging is, again, that's an educational tool. So
yeah.
When the students dissect it and see it, then they're getting a leg up on seeing and understanding that.
And so thanks a lot, Nathan. Hopefully that answered your question. And real quick, we're running out of time, but what happens to the bodies after they are done, whether it's 20 years or whatever it might be?
The far majority of our donors' families request the bodies be returned. So the cremains are returned to the family, usually within a two-year window.
So they're cremated,
mm-hmm.
And the cremated remains are returned
to the family.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, we learned a lot. Eileen Kalmar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Kirk McHugh as well.
Thank you.
Eileen Kelmar, Director of Anatomical Services and Body Donor Program at Ohio State University, where Kirk McHugh is the Divisional Director and Professor in the Department of Biomedical Education and Anatomy. Thanks a lot for listening. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.